Our next speaker is Dr. Tina Horbick. Dr. Horbick earned her PhD from Novozymes and the University of Copenhagen. After working a couple of years in academia, she joined the Chr. Hansen's company, where she currently serves as their specialist application manager in the Department of Meat and Food Safety, where her focus is on the development and application of bioprotective solutions in meat products. Dr. Horbick.
Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for the invitation to be here today to share some of the experiences we have at Chr. Hansen on assessing and maintaining probiotics in foods. First, a short outline of my talk today. I will give a very brief introduction into the trends we see in the market for probiotics foods. Then I will talk something about maintaining probiotics in foods, the influence of production and formulation when it comes to culture production formulation, the influence of food processing, the influence on the storage in the food matrix, and then I will talk something about how we assess the probiotics in food. First of all, the traditional plate counting methods. I will describe the flow cytometry method that we use, and I will give an example of a model we use to evaluate the subsequent survival of probiotics in the GI tract. So first of all, a short introduction to the trends we see in the market for probiotic foods. We see continued growth in most markets around the world. 95% of the current market is within fermented milk products, but we also see that probiotics are moving into other types of fresh foods, including various dairy foods, cheeses, ice cream, and drinking milk. We also see probiotics moving into soy-based products and fruit juices. What we also see around the world is an increased attention from regulatory side. In the EU, we have the EFSA organization looking very thoroughly into the health claims. And I think later today we'll hear something about the situation here in the US. We see an increased focus on credibility of probiotic foods when it comes to clinical documentation, thorough safety evaluation of the probiotics, and also when it comes to maintaining a sufficiently high cell count by the end of shelf life. So as I said before, we see an increased interest in the probiotics food, and this graph shows the number of new product launches within the area of probiotics food from 1998 and until today. And as you see, it's been a continued interest in this area. And when it comes to the different probiotic food segments, as I said before, the dairy products and specifically the yogurt-like products, they form the largest segment by far in the market for probiotics food. This is mainly, or this is probably due to the consumer perception of dairy products. They are generally considered healthy. Bacteria is a known phenomenon in yogurt, and consumers seem to prefer when functional ingredients are placed in a natural context. And if we take a look at the graphs below, in 1998, there were 18 new product launches within probiotic food products, and they were all in dairy. In 2009, there were 281 new product launches. And as I said before, we see that these new launches also appear in new product areas, including desserts, ice cream, and non-alcoholic beverages such as fruit juice. So today my talk will primarily deal with the probiotic applications in yogurts, and I will also briefly touch upon the new applications, the applications of fruit juices and other food products. We've seen this definition before today, that probiotics are live microorganisms that confer health benefits on the host when given in appropriate amounts. So my talk about maintaining probiotics in food will deal with how to maintain viability of the probiotics in food product. If we take a look at the life journey of a probiotic microorganisms, first of all, it has to be produced. It has to be formulated in some way. Then it's integrated into the food product during food processing. It has to stay viable in the food matrix throughout shelf life before it reaches the end consumer. And maintaining viability of the probiotics through this whole chain until it reaches the final destination is key to successful delivery in foods. First of all, you need to choose the right strain, and there are different strategies you can apply when choosing the strain. You can either choose the strain which is most fit for your food product, where you believe it will have the best chance of survival. Or you can choose based on the desired health claim you want to put on your food product. And at Chr. Hansen, we work mainly with these three strains that are listed here, the Bifidobacterium BB12 and Lactobacillus acidophilus LA5, which are related to clinical documentation on gastrointestinal health benefits. And then we have the Lactobacillus paracase I431, which is mainly related to clinical documentation on immune support benefits. But the choice of strain will for sure determine the ability to survive in the food product. The first step of the life journey for strain production and formulation, we are a culture producing company, Christian Hansen, and we provide our cultures as DBS solution. So we provide cultures either as frozen or freeze-dried products. So when we are developing a new probiotic culture, it's really important that we can ferment it in an industrial scale, that the culture is easy to concentrate, but also that it can survive the freezing and drying steps, and that the culture is stable in these different forms. As a culture-producing companies, we have different ways where we can influence the subsequent survival of the probiotic in the food matrix. We can use different adaptation strategies during production, and we can also we've seen that it's very important to harvest the cells at certain physiological states or growth phase. When we look at downstream processing, we have the chances of using encapsulation to increase subsequent survival, or use some kind of entrapment. There's been examples in the literature showing that entrapment in alginate beets might improve the survival. When we take the next step of the life journey, the food processing and incorporation of probiotic in the food product, and we think about yogurt, it's very important to choose the right strain and the right starter culture. What we have seen is the specific strain of Streptococcus thermophilus has a unique characteristic of improving growth of Bifidobacterium during fermentation of yogurt. We've also seen that a specific Lactococcus lactis strain improves the growth of Bifidobacterium during fermentation of milk, and we can actually achieve a cell count as high as 10 to the 8th, while we've seen that other strains negatively influence growth. So yogurt cultures having proteolytic or oxygen scavenging properties, they have generally shown to be beneficial to Bifidobacterium. And we provide both starter cultures for yogurt and the probiotics, so we have the chances of providing the right combination of starter culture and probiotics, giving the right probiotic cell count without compromising too much on the synthetic properties of the starter culture texturizing properties. Perhaps not so surprisingly, the inoculation level of the probiotic will influence the level you find in your food product. And fermentation temperature also influences cell count. For instance, if you take yogurt fermentation, this is a yogurt fermented with one of our cultures called YFL750, and we added the probiotic Lactobacillus paracase I431. And one day after fermentation, carried out at two different temperatures, 37 or 40 degrees Celsius, we see a higher cell count of the probiotic when fermented at 40 degrees. We also see a linear dosage response of the probiotic added. But the dosage response is not always linear, especially if you have an inhibitory food matrix or if you have some kind of antagonistic activities by the starter culture. It's important to ensure that the consumer gets the right dosage, that it's that you have a concentration of probiotic in your food product, which by taking in a realistic amount of product, food product will provide the daily dosage required. And for instance, for Bifidobacterium BB12, a billion cells a day is the dosage that has been used in most of the clinical studies where we have shown a good health benefit. So if you consider an appropriate yogurt serving size, daily size of 100 gram, and you want to achieve 10 to 9 cells as a daily dosage, you have to ensure that you have 10 to 7 cells per gram by the end of shelf life. And what we typically see during shelf life is a decrease in cell count. This is an example of yogurt made with different sugars, the high fructose corn syrup and liquid sucrose sugar, and in different concentrations, and the higher the content of high fructose corn syrup we have added, the lower end cell count we will get after 60 days. We've also seen that different protein types in different concentrations have an effect on probiotics. And we believe that the effect of these ingredients on the probiotic is both an effect direct effect of the ingredients on the probiotics, but also an effect on the starter culture, which will then subsequently affect the probiotic and the survival of the probiotic. pH of the food matrix is very important, and as we're moving into new food matrices such as fruit juices, we see a lower pH than we normally see in yogurts. This is an example of BB12 added to different types of fruit juices, and the pH of the fruit juices are listed on the to the right of the description of the fruit juices. And what we see here is that fruit juices such as blackcurrant, grapes, and grapefruit with very low pH, they result in a dramatic decrease in BB12 cell count. So survival seems to depend on pH, but it also seems to depend on the type of acid present. We work with apple juice, and even in apple juices where the pH was comparable to orange juice, we saw a larger decline in the probiotic cell count, probably due to the content of malic acid. So the acid type of acid being present has an influence, and also we typically see that in berry type juices where natural antimicrobials are present, there's a large decline in probiotic cell count. When it comes to yogurt, we also have indications that there's a correlation between the degree of post-acidification and the survival of BPD bacterium during storage. The storage temperature also has an effect. This is an example where we added BB12 and LA5 to chocolate spread. And when we stored the chocolate spread at 8 degrees, shown by the blue and the red graph, we see a better survival of BB12 compared to the one stored at 25 degrees Celsius, shown by the green and the purple graph. And even slightly lower storage temperatures also affect survival. This is an example from orange juice kept at 4 degrees Celsius, which shows a 2-log better survival rate than when stored at 8 degrees Celsius. When it comes to dissolved oxygen, we've seen that, well, it's known that generally Lax bacilli are more oxygen tolerant than bifidobacterium, and considering the process of yogurt making, you would have a decrease in oxygen tension when you do the deep treatment and deaeration of the milk prior to fermentation. When you then do the pumping and filling after fermentation, you might have a small increase in the concentration of dissolved oxygen. And then during storage, there might be some permeation of oxygen depending on the container you choose for storing your product. What we've seen, for instance, is with orange juice kept at 8 degrees, that we get a better survival of BB12 when the orange juice is kept in Tetra Pak cartons with an oxygen barrier compared to glass bottles. There's a lot of other factors influencing the survival of probiotics in the food matrix, and I just listed a few others. For instance, the presence of cereal and cereal components such as oat and wheat bran shown to have a positive effect on some probiotics. The use of preservatives, for instance, potassium sulfate here in the U.S., has shown in some cases to have a negative influence on the survival of probiotics. And then there's the water activity, which has found to be critical in dry products such as cereal products. Next part of my talk is the assessment of probiotics in food and a small example of how we try to evaluate or get an indication on the subsequent survival in the gastrointestinal tract. It's crucial that we know we have the right strains in the right concentrations. We use species identification 16S or 23S ribosomal RNA and DNA fingerprinting mainly for our research and development purposes and also in our quality control of our cultures. And we also have a full genome sequence of our probiotic strains, which enable us to do a lot of characterizations that we already heard about earlier today. But for enumeration of probiotics in food products, the most commonly used methods by far is the use of traditional plate counting. And the method you choose depends on your application. If you have probiotics in your products, a single strain, for instance, in a fruit beverage where you do not expect to have background flora, you can use the optimal method for the probiotic. But if you're working with cultures where you have a mixture of cultures, or if you work in products where you suspect there might be some contamination or background flora, you have to use selective methods. And these selective methods are mainly based upon the use of antibiotics or the use of special incubation condition, temperature, or oxygen availability. I'll show you two examples here today. For instance, for the enumeration of Lactobacillus acidophilus, we follow the IDF standard 192. We slightly modified it. This is a method where you use antibiotics, and if the product contains Lactobacillus casei or rhamnosus, you have to use an antibiotic, clindamycin and ciprofloxacin. But when you know that the fermented milk product doesn't contain these, we only use the clindamycin to suppress the background flora. For enumeration of bifidobacteria, we use the IDF standard 220, and again, we follow the guidelines, but we've adapted it to our culture, and we've seen that the use of MRS with cystine hydrochloride added is supporting the growth of BB12 equally well as touch medium, which is recommended in the standard. We also reduced the amount of mupirocin used to inhibit the background culture because we found half the doses is sufficient, and it significantly reduces the cost of the analysis. We use flow cytometry as an alternative cell count method, and this is used more commonly in our labs. This allows us to detect active cells that have a membrane potential. We stain with the fluorescent stain called Diax, and we cells that are active and have a membrane potential will have a red-shifted fluorescence after staining with this dye. And this is an example of the results we get by using flow cytometry. This is a yogurt with out BB12 and the same yogurt that has been added BB12. In the top two graphs, we have the forward scatter against the side scatter, which is an indication of the granularity and the size of the cells. And when we add a certain amount of stained beads, we can get a count of the total cell count in the yogurt. Then if we look at the lower graphs, and we have here a indication of the red fluorescence, again the green fluorescence, we get a subpopulation of active BB12 cells. And with the use of this method, we have a total cell count of our yogurt, we have a total cell count of BB12, and a count of the active BB12. We have validated the method, and we see really good correlation to the typical plate counting method, and we also see a good linear dose response when we add different amounts of freeze-dried BB12 material, and we count the active, inactive, and total amount of BB12. And we have developed this into a high-throughput analysis, where we have first step rehydration of cells. Then we have a second step where we activate the cells in the medium. In this case, it's MRS for the BB12. And then we do cell staining with the Diax before flow cytometry. And this actually enables us to do 96 samples in less than 3.5 hours, which is a little bit faster than the plate counting method. So today we talked a little bit about, or there's been some talking about the influence of food matrix on the probiotic properties, and we try to evaluate the effect of different food matrices and other of these factors that are shown today on the subsequent survival of our probiotics in a model of the GI tract. And this is a computer-controlled dynamic gastrointestinal model we use called TIM, and it's from the Dutch Institute TNO. And in the top of this model, we feed continental breakfast to TIM, and we can add probiotics. We can simulate through this model the condition of the human stomach and the small intestine. We can adjust pH in a different compartment. We can give sequential input of enzymes, cofactors, biosols in physiological amounts, and we can also mimic the transit times for each step of digestion. And then finally, here at the bottom, we can remove the products of digestion. So we use TIM to sort of get an indication in our development and research work to get an indication of the effect of matrix on the resistance to this gastric transit. And also we look at the effect of fermentation and formulation on the resistance to the transit, downstream processing, multi-strain products. We use it for characterization of our strains and to achieve a picture of the probiotics activity in the gastrointestinal tract. And the example shown to the right is an example where we added BB12 to the TIM model either in the form of yogurt or in the form of powder. And we measured the recovery over time, and as you can see here, the recovery of BB12 given in these two forms were quite comparable. So I have three messages that you can choose to take home today. The first message is that the market for probiotics is dominated by fermented milk products, but expanding into new non-dairy application. And we also see the increased attention from regulatory side worldwide. Maintaining probiotics in food depends on many different conditions during culture production, during formulation, during food processing and food storage. So it's important to choose the right strategy. And assessment of probiotics in food can be based on selective or non-selective traditional plate count methods or on high throughput methods such as flow cytometry. And I would like to thank a list of my colleagues who have all contributed to this presentation today. And finally, I'd like to thank you for your attention. Any questions? Yes. I know that thorough studies have been made by the Dutch Institute, TNO, on this specific matter, because they want to, of course, provide a model which simulates human conditions as much as possible. I didn't bring any of those kind of documentation today, but I know that they've been working very much on it also. They have, I mean, when you run the model, you choose different programs depending on what age group you're looking for. The transit times will differ. The amount of enzymes will differ also. So they very much try to validate the model also against different age groups to simulate that. Mm. Okay. Mm. Yeah. I think the TIM model should be seen as a first indication before you choose to do clinical trials. It cannot be done in replace it. No. Yes.
If one of the slides on
yes.
Very impressive. It's almost one log. It's a pretty sharp drop. It's able to set a pretty compound combination of one product. It's initially loss of viability.
We see it in some food products, and we also see that it's very strain dependent. For instance, in fruit juices, the BB12 that I show you today shows sort of a slow decline in cell count. But if you take, for instance, the paraphase, you typically see a rapid decline, and then you'll see a population which is quite stable. So it differs.